Welcome to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast, where we focus on the people, the products, and the process of e-commerce selling today. Here's your host, Stephen Peterson.
E-Commerce Momentum Podcast, Episode 42, Brandon Dubsky. Man, I'll tell you, if you want to hear a story about somebody who, you know, kind of built an amazing business, did it exactly the right way, went to college, went to grad school, got an MBA, built business plans, executed on the business plans, built a successful business, up over $18 million, top 10 eBay seller, early adopter of eBay e-commerce practices, and then lost it all. It started outside of his control, but he made some choices, and he would say they weren't the right choices, and he should have seen some things coming earlier. And the way he handled it, the way he continues to handle it, is very, very impressive. And in this segment, we spend some time talking about how the business got built up, how he got to that place of selling $1.5 million. Some of the lessons, you'll hear lessons in there, and you'll say to yourself, this isn't going to end well. And I just think it's such a great story because the lessons he can teach you in growing your business from an e-commerce business that he was doing 18 years ago are still practical today. So let's get into the podcast. All right, welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. And tonight's guest is a legend of sorts. I met him at the Ecom Chicago conference, which I really enjoyed myself out at that conference. I think that it opened up a different group, at least to me and a few of the other more Amazon sellers, and it was a lot of eBay sellers there, and it was really cool. But I met some amazing people, and one of the people that I met was a gentleman named Brandon Dubsky. Welcome, Brandon.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you for having me.
And what was so cool was he told the story, but then the next morning we got to have breakfast together, and man, the knowledge that you have and have forgotten is incredible, and it's just such a powerful story, and I think it's a great story for this time of year. I kind of mentioned to you offline before we started is that I think this time of year people are having a lot of success or they're not. And when you're having a lot of success, hey, I mean, times are rolling and things are great. But if you're not, you're thinking you're doing something wrong. You think it's you. You think it happens to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody isn't – everything's not unicorn and rainbows, right? I mean, it does – things can be rough sometimes, correct?
Oh, yeah. Business is a cycle. You always have your ups and you always have your downs, and you got to learn how to ride them and ride them through and get to the next wave.
Well, I think your story of riding them through is an incredible one because I think it's going to be hard for people to get their arms around. New sellers are going to struggle understanding if you have not sold on eBay and you realize, if you've never sold on eBay, you won't have the frame of reference because Amazon does make the world a lot easier. eBay still is a challenge, but in older days, it was a real challenge just to get listings created and get things done. And you've been selling on eBay, am I correct, 18 years?
Yep. So it's about 18 years, 1998. So that when I started, there was less than 1 million people, not just sellers, just people on eBay at the time.
So just imagine that. You know, the internet was really, you know, the internet is what, a little over 20-something, I mean, the commercial internet, I guess I should say. Al Gore invented it, you know, 100 years ago. But the real internet, the commercial internet's a little over 20 years, right? eBay just celebrated its 20th anniversary, as a matter of fact. So you were one of the real, real early adopters. But you didn't just adopt it. You went hog wild.
I embraced it, yeah, absolutely.
All right, so we're going to get to that story, but let's go back even further because you're not that old. What did you do? Where did your career start?
Oh, I'm older than you think. So my background before my e-commerce career was in logistics and operations management type stuff. So I'm a numbers guy. I also got my MBA degree right at the early days. I was finishing up my MBA in business, of course, master's in business. At the same time, I was basically writing the business plan for my first e-commerce company.
So, I mean, and that would have been before you launched it. So that's almost 20 years ago, kind of at the start of eBay, really.
Yeah, it was it was why I took certain classes in my MBA degree so I could write a business plan and kind of prove to myself that all these crazy ideas in my head might be something fun to pursue before quitting that corporate job, so to speak.
And so you had some logistic experience. So you saw the warehousing, the inflows, the outflows, and how to handle that kind of thing.
Yep.
So you were not intimidated by that at all, because I think that's one of the big intimidating things. And back then, it would have been manual, right? It would have been, or it would have been done on big mainframes.
Oh yeah, the old operational computers, you know, the keyboards, the green screens, the you know, the green bar printers, all that stuff, faxing in orders to factories and suppliers and so forth. So yeah, it was a paper and pencil back then, before even email was a tool to use.
Okay, so you embrace the technology of the time, which was, let's face it, cutting edge, and at that time you decided to go into business for yourself. Now, did you realize how large of a business you were going to have? Did your business plan say, I'm going to sell millions of dollars?
Of course. I mean, I'm an entrepreneur. I wanted to be big. Okay, so that was, you know, the plan, I guess. In the beginning, the plan that I wrote during my MBA courses, my entrepreneurship courses, was to build eBay drop-off stores all across the country. And so it was a lot like, you know, the drop-off model that you saw, you know, you've seen in the last 5 to 10 years, right? It was pencil and paper. I was going to have retail stores everywhere where people would bring in items and companies would bring in surplus inventory, you know, through the back door. But and we would sell it on eBay for them, more like a consignment. So that was the original business plan that I wrote. And I took this business plan to business plan competitions, in both academic and in the real world, to venture capitalists. And the feedback I kept getting from these venture capitalists and from the academia judges, I suppose, would tell me, hey, don't do that. You know, the retail model, you're going to have all this overhead, all these employees, a lot of moving parts. Do the wholesale. You know, do it with warehouses where they focus on the surplus inventory and sell it for them. And so I got a lot of great feedback even before I really, really, really started, I suppose. And that helped me form that original business model.
You know, when you started with eBay, was there any – I guess Yahoo would have been the only other place to really sell, right?
Oh, gosh. You know, there was a ton of them. I mean, if you looked at my business plan, there was a ton of them. There was like a UBID back then. You had,
okay, I remember
you
that,
know,
yeah.
Bidder's Edge. I'm not sure if that was actually a marketplace. Gosh, I had all these logos. You're right. Yahoo was on there. But there was all these names that they don't even exist today. I mean, they're just – boom, they're gone.
And I'm going to jump ahead and ask this question. So when Amazon started in 94, right, or 95, whenever it really got started, maybe 96, were you still hog wild in eBay?
So when Amazon started, it was funny. I used to be in class in school at the university, college courses, and Amazon was a case study. You know, is there really – I mean, I remember sitting there discussing for hours, is there really a business model to sell books online? And so we used to love just, you know, tearing apart the pluses and minuses of Amazon's business, you know, in those early days. So, you know, it was always – I was aware of it from that perspective, I guess, when they started.
Okay. Okay, so you didn't start – when you started on eBay, Amazon was not on your radar to go to.
Well, they did not allow sellers to sell on their marketplace for many years. It was in 2001 or 2-ish, maybe even 3 or 4-ish. I don't even remember. But I was actually one of their very first – not their first, but one of their probably top first 100 sellers on their marketplace when they started the marketplace.
Wow.
Yeah, because of relationships, and my company was big at the time, so they came to me and approached me and said, we're opening a third-party marketplace. Would you like to sell on it?
Well, that's a great segue. So let's talk about how big your company got. All right, so let's go back to the beginning. You had this idea. You were going to create some business model, and so take it from there.
Okay, so, you know, after getting my MBA degree, graduated, I had a little more free time on my hands. I was still doing the corporate world. I was not comfortable, you know, just jumping in head first. So it was kind of a parallel thing. I was doing a lot of those, you know, early days, a lot of stuff like everybody else. It's garage sales, thrift stores. It's the retail arbitrage early day-ish, you know, business model. And then obviously, you know, that gets old and tired after a while because of all the work to find products. And so then it's, you know, wholesaling. And, you know, because of my operational background, I was pretty good at going to big companies and saying, let me buy your surplus or let me consign.
Well, stop there a second. Tell me about that. So you were way back in the day doing what basically is liquidation in essence, really, right? If they're sitting on a whole bunch of inventory and you're dealing with it from the warehouse, were you buying it right from warehouse, logistic warehouse companies that were doing distribution for people?
For the most part, yeah. So it was I had both options available. So I would, if I felt like it was a good purchase, I would buy it cash up front, right? And buy, you know, a truckload of these and a truckload of those eventually. At that scale.
Does that still exist? And the reason I say that, because I know it does, and I'm going to give you an example. There's a logistics company in my market that I bought a particular toy from, and it turns out that they were located close to me. And I'm like, wait a second, you're a California company. Well, we use this logistic company in your area. Mm-hmm. Went through the whole thing. I was able to go to their back dock and pick it up, so I saved all the freight. And it was a pretty big item, so it worked out really well. I'm in their warehouses, and they had 60 or 70 companies, and there was inventory as far as the eye can see. And I talked to one of the owners, and I'm like, hey, would you be interested in selling? You know, now I got to deal with each person, and they handle their customer service and everything. So it's a little more complicated. So that does exist today, and it existed back then. Were you one of the real few interested in doing that back in those days?
Yeah, I mean, it was a model that I never saw a lot of other people doing yet. Liquidation.com, there was a surplus company, I can't remember the name, surplusinventory.com or something similar. But yes, I mean, it was a model that very few people were doing, especially on eBay. So a lot of eBay was more one-off stuff, and I felt like it was better to do the surplus inventory, right? And that,
it's genius. Yeah.
And my background in logistics helped me, you know, see that opportunity because I saw the pains of the, you know, internally for companies with surplus. And so, yeah, I mean, we would buy inventory or consign it. So one of the big clients that I caught early on was Rubbermaid. Rubbermaid would ship me truckloads and truckloads of things like high chairs and trash cans and garbage bags. I mean, they're not sexy items, but they're very profitable because of the Rubbermaid brand name back then when, you know, you could sell a discontinued model at, you know, maybe 60 to 70% retail, right? But you're getting it at liquidation costs.
So you're paying 10 cents on the dollar, selling it at 40 cents on the dollar, and still making boatloads of money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And you had a warehouse at that point?
Oh, of course, yeah. So in the early days, I actually I'm a very cautious person, honestly. So before I even had my first warehouse, so I'm out of school, I actually found a local distribution company here in Lincoln, Nebraska, where I'm from, and I said, hey, I'll sell some of your stuff online for you if I can rent. Like or use like in exchange for an office, right? In their office compartment, our office and warehouse space. So they emptied out a closet that they were using as a closet. That was a big closet, but this closet ended up being my first office outside of my home. And I hired three interns from the university to help me. So there was four of us with dial-up internet access using what was other people considered a closet for our first office. And it allowed me to bring inventory into their warehouse. So I didn't even own a warehouse. I wasn't paying rent. And I could have a truckload drop off stuff at a dock to me. And so that was very, in my opinion, pretty creative at the time.
I think it's another great idea that you can bring to today. You know, think back, right? This is, you know, almost 20 years ago, 18 years ago. Those same opportunities exist today with the downsizing of many companies or the outsourcing of responsibilities in companies. A lot of companies used to have 400 employees. Now they have 150. They still have the space. They're still paying for it. So they will sublease some space. And if you can be creative enough to trade that sublease by helping them get rid of their product, protecting their brand and all that kind of jazz, I think that's a great idea. I think that's really good thinking. I didn't even think about it. And I think it's applicable today. I think those opportunities exist today.
Absolutely.
So that's two pieces that are back. It's like clothes, right? They come back into style.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is another great example. All right, go ahead.
Yeah,
keep going.
I mean, barter for things you want without having to, you know, fully invest until you've proven your concept.
Right. That's exactly right. In the beginning, all cash should be used for inventory. You don't need forklifts. You don't need any of that jazz, right? Everything should be used for inventory as much as possible. So stay Spartan in that beginning. I think that's great until you do prove that concept. So go ahead.
Love it. I love it. Yeah, I mean, so things, you know, accelerated. After I graduated from college, it was and kind of did this parallel work, the full-time job, do this, you know, business out of a closet / office for a while. I finally realized this is going to be big if I just commit to it. So I did a you know, I did a negotiation with my employer saying, hey, you know, let me work part-time for 6 months so I can, you know, do this business. And, you know, it all worked out. I had a great relationship. So I was able to ease myself out of the corporate world and into the entrepreneurial world, which was very, you know, I was lucky to have that situation. We're fortunate. But things were a rocket ship. I mean, after that, I was working full time on this. I had interns working for me at that point, and we were just taking full advantage of the market opportunity because it was such early times and demand far exceeded supply on eBay back then. So you could sell anything profitably. And our goal was to try to, you know, I guess, find those pockets of opportunity on the supply side and just build it. And we did.
I have a question about that. So how did you, you know, I mean, I get it. Everything sells, right? Because all of a sudden, you know, it's probably word of mouth, right? They're just like, oh, my God, you wouldn't believe I was able to find, you know, a Nolan Ryan baseball card that, you know, we bought everything in our market. Now I can get one. I got one shipped from California, blah, 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 right? How was the shipping back then? Mm-hmm. I don't have a frame of reference to understand. I mean, how was UPS hot and heavy? FedEx, what was the way you used to ship?
Okay, so early days, early in the beginning, it was all U.S. Post Office still. So it's the same thing that a lot of people start up today. It's pack those boxes, and they didn't have flat rate or, you know, priority mailboxes back then. Everything was, you know, reused boxes and so forth. But pack those boxes and lug them to the post office because they wouldn't pick up at your house, you know, back then, unless you had a meter back then. And yeah. You had to have a real meter, not a computerized one, right? Lugging every day, you're going to the post office with 20, 50, you know, boxes, you know, until they let you go to the back door. And then, you know, UPS kind of, you know, came to surface as a more viable option. And they still had to learn their ways, you know, and then FedEx would want your business, and they had to learn the way, you know, of an e-commerce, you know, industry. They were still learning this e-commerce industry the same time we were, right? And so a lot of, you know, bumps and scratches along the way, I'd say.
Well, I mean, you know, it's just fascinating to think about that you were pretty much in the start of that, too. You know, we take it for granted. Again, you know, if you ever see Greg Murphy's operation where he uses DHL, and it's a fascinating operation to see this massive Gaylord box with books in it that he ships, and then it goes sorted out. I mean, it's a crazy system. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't have existed back then. And to think about it, back in those older days, like you're saying, where you couldn't, I mean, you had very little, I mean, the delivery times must have been incredible, right? They must have taken a long time to get a package across the country back then because it, you know, it wasn't set up for this, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was slower. So I remember opening envelopes after envelopes, getting checks and cash in the mail every day. I mean, there was no PayPal back then yet. I remember, you know, when X.com came to the market first. And this was pre, you know, online payments and pre, you know, organized shipping. But you're opening envelopes and cashing checks all day long, and then you're shipping stuff that could take 5 to 7 days. There, you know, most stuff didn't have tracking numbers necessarily back then, and so there was a lot more trust involved with things, and a lot more, you know, a lot more things, problems to fix, I suppose. But and manual processes, paper and pencil, spreadsheets, and so forth. So. Good time.
The customer service must have been incredible back then. I mean, you just because, you know, everything had to be done over the phone or, like you said, fax or mail, right? And we take it for granted again that there's a messaging service within an eBay or an Amazon where you don't even have to – or in most cases in Amazon, we don't even deal with the customer 95% of the time, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, as I grew my company, obviously things got bigger. You know, the volumes got bigger. We were at one point, you know, UPS's largest ground shipper out of Lincoln, Nebraska, which is, you know, the capital of Nebraska here. And so that was a big deal. I mean, we actually grew things – from, you know, nothing to the top of eBay back in the 2002-2003 time frame. So speaking of customer service, I had 17 customer service, full-time customer service reps, you know, coming in, answering the phones, answering emails, you know, solving problems, trying to keep everybody happy with all that volume of transactions. I mean, we were selling everything. I mean, tools, toys, sporting goods, computers, you know, clothing, you name it.
And at that point, it was all new, but it was liquidated. And so they had the headsets on. The phones were ringing back then, right? They weren't, you know, they were ringing loud. It must have been an exciting time.
Yeah, it's like a customer call center, right? You know, everybody had their headsets. Yep, and we had to build our own computer system, you know, to really manage the data. So, and that's a whole, you know, we could do a whole 1 hour podcast about the computer systems and stuff. But basically, you know, order processing. inventory control, the merchandising of products, the intelligence and dashboards and calculations, but also customer service, so that we could find their orders, find their tracking numbers, figure out where the problems are, and then track it. This item always has a lot of problems. When you have so many items coming from so many vendors, you have to know, you have to be able to see the data to say, oh, we're having a lot of problems with this vendor, and that's hard to say.
How much did you spend in that system back then? Any guess? Any clue? Just a guess.
I do know.
I mean, would you say?
I know. It was about $500,000 in software.
Think about that. I mean, we take it for granted. Again, you could just download Excel for, $70 or something like that. I mean, or, the whole Office Suite program. You can get QuickBooks at $99 or something now. I don't even know what it costs. I mean, it's so ridiculous. And you don't even need that. You can use FreshBooks, which is just a web application, right? Again, another thing that we don't have a frame of reference to think about how difficult that journey's been. But you built up an amazingly successful eBay business. So take us up to the point of stay in the success mode. I don't want to go we'll take that after break. But take us through the success of eBay. You grew big.
Yeah, I mean, it was fun. I mean, like I said, it was a rocket ship. So we were hiring, 7-8 new employees every month. And so, month after month, that gets wears on you. So we were going through all those challenges of control our growth, right? Our sales were growing so fast. So then we had to build the operations to keep up with it, the software to keep up with it. And, things were starting to change quicker and quicker and quicker, whether it was the shipping companies, whether it was, the competition, whether it was eBay making a change that could totally change your business model, or they make a change in the software and then your software wasn't compatible. So things, started moving extremely fast. And when we were flying up, pretty high back then, a small change could make a big impact in my business. And so, it was fun, but it was also extremely challenging because of you're like it's like you're on the edge of the cliff all the time.
Yeah, it must have been every day you're waiting for something new to explode. Did you have HR people at that point, and payroll people, and accounting folks, and all that kind of jazz?
Absolutely. I mean, I had a full-time HR person. Their job was to hire, fire, and maintain happiness, I suppose. Full-time. CFO, so with three accounting people in-house, because we would receive 1,000 paper invoices in the mail every single day from drop shippers. And so, we had to verify if that invoice was valid. Was it ours? Because they were out of control as well. Back in the early days, this was all new to the drop shippers, as well. So, so a big accounting team, a big operations team, warehouse team, customer service, and then merchandising. Merchandising was a big task, bringing in new products, finding new products. How do we get it listed on Amazon, eBay, and our websites, right? And how do we control all that?
But did you have a studio to take pictures? I mean, did you get to that sophistication?
Oh, yeah. We had conveyor systems with photos. We had conveyors. Not really liquid closeout stuff, so one-off stuff, sometimes, buybacks from lost freight type stuff. And so we had systems in place where the stuff would come off the truck on a conveyor. It would cross a photo studio booth, or, on the conveyor, it would stop at a photo, and then it would go down a conveyor to a merchandiser who they could then merchandise a used item, let's say, in probably 2 minutes or less. And so there was a lot of technology.
What does that mean? So tell us what that means.
In merchandising, in my definition, I suppose, is having that photo, describing it, what category it is, writing the description, putting it, what's the price, what's the weight for shipping, and so on and so forth. So taking it from a physical item and getting it digitized, I suppose, to be listed.
Okay. And were you able to cross-list back then?
What do you mean by cross-list?
Well, you'd list it on eBay. It was used. I guess you wouldn't have been on Amazon. Would you put it on your own website at that point, too?
Okay, so yeah, I mean, our inventory system would track eBay, Amazon, and our own websites. If it was new, and we would have it on all three, and then once it sells, it would pull it from the other two. Yeah, so we tracked all that in-house, yes.
And that was custom software again back then, because it didn't exist, right? Today, again, we sit back and say, wow, AutoMCF does it automatically. Yes, yeah. And it's not that expensive relative to that $500,000. That's incredible.
I would never do that again. Never build it from scratch again.
Okay. So, at this point, are you one of the top 10 sellers on eBay yet?
Absolutely. I mean, in 2002, 2003, we were in the top 10, whether it was one, two, or three. It was before the car dealerships started coming online because they sell cars, they sell high dollar prices. You know, they could surpass me on a gross dollar level fairly quickly eventually. And then the Disneys came on board. They started getting Dell and Gateway. So eBay started changing the landscape. They went corporate and they started going after – they were feeling hungry, so they started going after product.
Okay, so that was 2002, 2003. Do you care to say what your sales were that year?
Well, we were running at a rate of $1.5 million a month.
A month.
Yep.
and think about it. You're paying, what, 10 cents on the dollar for most of these products because you're buying, as you said, closeouts, liquidations, shelf pulls, that kind of jazz, right? Mm-hmm. So your margins must have been incredible.
It varied. I mean, so the surplus in the liquidations was one of our business. We also drop shipped. I mean, we were drop shipping from 50 different warehouses every day. And so our system would automatically disperse the orders. They could log in. They could see their orders, print them, enter the tracking, and it would come back to us. And so, we also did drop shipping, which would be less profitable but higher volume, right?
Okay.
And then we also did consignment. So the profit margins varied based on the business model, based on the product category, based on how competitive it is. But of course, like you said, the liquidation and the surplus was definitely the most profitable most times.
Was everything still selling generally back then too?
Oh, it became harder and harder. Yeah. I mean, at that point, competition was really just swarming. I mean, people were coming on board, it wasn't as easy to make money back then or, price. And so it wasn't as easy to make profit.
Okay, so it's almost like a perfect storm we're describing, right? Because as you're saying, there's all of a sudden enormous competition out there, right? Everybody else is figuring this out. There's, incredible demand. I mean, let's face it, everybody's buying. But then you start to see things on the horizon, other companies coming in, like you said, Disney, direct sellers, right? Mm-hmm. They're taking you out of the picture. So, all right, let's go to break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what happens next.
Absolutely.
And I think the lesson here is that, that perfect storm, that everybody's going to run into a storm. It's preparing for how you react, how you recover from it, which is really going to be the lesson. I think Brandon's story is going to really, really be compelling to you. So we'll be right back.
Excited to bring on a new sponsor today, YourSourcedInventory.com. That's YourSourcedInventory.com, where they focus on shoes and clothing, great gated categories, high average selling price. Remember that high average selling price with a good return of investment means more profit in your pocket. Here's some stats they sent me for September. In shoes, they averaged the top 2%, average rank of 7,000, net profit of almost $30 with an ROI of 89%. Those are good numbers. Clothing, top 2 to 3%, average rank was 4,132, net profit of about $12, and ROI again of 104%. Those are great. These are online deals that are sent to you 5 days a week. You get 10 items a day. You're going to be able to grow your business from the comfort of your home. This is exactly what we needed for our business. It's the reason we're using them. So we think this is a great way that you can move forward in a great category. YourSourcedInventory.com. YourSourcedInventory.com.
Okay, I hope you're sitting on the edge of your seat because you know I am. We built a great business. It's as large as really possible. I mean, it's just incredible to think of all that Brandon has accomplished at this point. But you'll notice he talked about some things that were on the horizon, some things that weren't in his control. I think, again, that's a lesson that's relevant for today. Gated categories. Gated brands, right? How many brands have you seen lately? They seem to be accelerating. Counterfeit claims, packaging requirements, bagging requirements, box content requirements coming soon. eBay not listing listings not working this past weekend, and I don't know how many people that affected. So I guess the premise and the lesson is going to be is that you are not in control of your e-commerce business if you are on some other platform. And trust me, we're guilty of it. We're knee-deep in it. Brandon has been able to build an unbelievably successful e-commerce business. Not on Amazon or eBay anymore. He's still on them, but that's not where his business is. And he's going to talk about that in this segment. Let's get back into the podcast.
All right, we're back, and we're talking with Brandon Dubsky, and he is I'm on the edge of my seat. Want to hear more about this incredible story of incredible success, starting out being one of the few, you know, as you say, top 100 sellers on eBay, starting out growing to one of the top 10 sellers on e-commerce in general, because you were selling on your own website, Amazon and eBay. What percentage of your sales were on each? Could you say? I mean, would you say 25, 25, 50, or what would you say?
So back then, it was all eBay. I mean, in the very early days, it was only eBay, right? And as we started growing, we're like, okay, Amazon came to us and said, we're building a marketplace. So we jumped on Amazon as a second marketplace. But as the competition started hitting, right, and we started having to battle on price and battle on, you know, against people head-to-head on eBay, we realized a website was really important. So we started building our own branded websites, and we did multiple branded websites for different types of products and so forth. We did experience, but back then, in those early years, it was totally, you know, eBay was dominant. You know, I would say it was almost 90% of our business, you know, maybe 80 after Amazon, because Amazon was still early. So a lot of people weren't shopping on Amazon for electronics or other things besides books. And so there was still this kind of lag effect from a supply demand standpoint on Amazon that most people are, you know, would never have experienced, don't experience that today because it's totally different. But so eBay was still our dominant channel.
You mentioned you had multiple websites. How many websites were you managing back in 2002, 2003?
I would say three or four retail websites. So not a ton. Not a ton.
Okay, so not a ton. But they were specialized, themed, right?
Right.
Kind of, you know, tools or whatever, cameras or what have you. Okay, so everything was great. Life was good, but the storm started. Disney, Hasbro, those companies started coming in, started selling their own merchandise. That meant that they started figuring out their logistic issues, right? Because you were really arbitraging their logistic issues, right?
Somewhat, yeah. Their supply chain and the demand channel, right? So we were the liquidator, you know, liquidating surplus inventory. And once some of those companies started going direct, yes, that was somewhat of a threat to our business.
And so then unicorns, rainbows, and the world went on to a great place, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or did things not go so well?
So, things, you know, the ride wasn't as smooth, let's say. So the rocket ship was bouncing. But really what was going on is all this domestic competition initially, right? All the turbulence was coming from domestic competitors. And so we focused our sights on the domestic competitors. It was the other small companies that started selling on eBay because, you know, all the news that there's this great opportunity to sell on eBay back then, right? And so we dialed in our computer system to be extremely competitive domestically. And that was our strength. I mean, a new competitor would come in, we could beat them with auto pricing and very, you know, highly intelligent listing strategies, I suppose, right? And we were able to be very competitive, even at the top, with lots of moving parts domestically. What came, and this is the surprise around the corner that I totally missed and I totally did not expect or predict, was China. So, and that's really direct, okay? That's going straight to the factories, to the source. eBay opened up an office in 2004 in China, and their job was to get sellers or companies or people in China to sell on eBay. And basically they hired staff. I mean, I'm not telling any secrets here. They hired staff and they went to all the top eBay sellers, you know, printed off our pages and went to our store, shared links and said, okay, these are the top sellers on eBay. You can copy them, right? And so instantly or very quickly after that, I was targeted numero uno, right? Right at the top from all these Chinese sellers selling electronics and tools and toys and sporting goods just like me, but off-brand at a price that I could not even touch.
Were they manufacturing them then at that point, or were they still – because manufacturing wouldn't have been in China at that point, right? It would have still been in Taiwan or – Was it just starting to really develop in China at that point?
For electronics, it was definitely from China. So lot of the, you know, I was very heavy in car audio, car video, car electronics, and also some home. And so all of those electronics were coming straight from China through Hong Kong onto eBay. And so that was a new threat that we totally kind of missed. We never saw it coming, but we also didn't accept it. I was still competing domestically, you know, I was still relying on my system and our intelligence and our programming to fight this battle that we were starting to lose.
And do you think back, now thinking back, I mean, of course, you know, hindsight's 20/20. Did you ignore the signs? I mean, you know, and I don't want to make you feel bad or anything like that, but I mean, was the writing on the wall and you just rationalized around it? Because I find myself doing that, mm-hmm. and I'm talking about myself, and I'm just wondering if that a common trait?
Yeah, I mean, I always discounted that threat in the sense that people don't want to buy from international customers. They don't want to wait for long shipping. You know, even though it's cheaper, they don't want cheap products, right? And so you always talk yourself. I mean, we're, as entrepreneurs, we're all very good at this, right? We can, if we feel like we're better than somebody else, we can rationalize it with all these different reasons. We forget about all the, you know, the other half of that coin. And so, yeah, I mean, I totally discounted it and ignored it to some degree. I mean, obviously, once that threat continued to eat into my market share and continued to eat into my market share and continued, and it caused a lot of pain, you know, from my business standpoint, right? Financially and operationally and so forth. I, you know, my model went from a rocket ship, you know, flying at a 30 degrees angle up month after month to a 30 degree angle down month after month. And so, you know, once that, you know, kicks in month after month after month, then you realize, okay, this threat is real. How do I battle this?
So that point, you put your head down and worked harder.
You know, well, you know, then you make start making tough decisions. Okay, you know, I was, you know, then having to lay off employees, which was the hardest thing to ever do for me, at least personally, right? Laying off mm-hmm. employees, not for their performance necessarily, but based on what I considered my performance as a mm-hmm. CEO of a company, right? I felt mm-hmm. like I failed them. And so that was a very emotional time for me to have to lay off employees who came to work, you know, because I, you know, I helped them get a job, but they were helping me build my vision, right? Or my dream. And so I felt bad about laying people off. That was tough, right? And then it's a matter of right-sizing your company, right? Making your business profitable again at a smaller scale. Even though, you know, you've got $500,000 invested in inventory or in technology, and you've got, you know, warehousing and operational overheads and all these things, you're trying to, you know, basically catch a falling knife, you know?
Yeah. Did you consider those sunk costs at that point, or were you going to save it?
I was trying to save it. It was always, yeah. You know, to me, I felt like this, I could push through this problem. I could readjust my business model. And so I started going to factories in China to source products. You know, I was starting to source products in 2005, 2006, right? And doing drop shipping out of China. I was actually drop shipping products on eBay from China. Back in 2006 or five, right? That's so I was exploring those business models to try to survive this new world, a global world.
Okay, so you go through, and as you described it, I think it's so aptly, is that you're saying, hey, I'm trying to catch a falling knife, right? I'm going to save everything. I'm going to cut where I have to. Yeah, it's painful, but I'm going to be able to – we're going to make it through there. We're going to push through. We're going to push through. You weren't able to push through, correct?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it was have a heart attack and leave my family way too early, or put, you know, close the business and go out of business. And so I, you know, I finally made that toughest decision in 2006. I had filed bankruptcy, and it was ugly. I mean, you know, when one of the top sellers on eBay files bankruptcy, it's on all the news channels, and you know, it's everywhere, blog posts and so forth. And so it was a very public, you know, explosion, you know. And so I had to go through that painful time. But, you know, e-commerce was still in my blood and entrepreneurship was still in my blood. I did not want to go find that 9-to-5 job for somebody else. And so I, you know, it was one of those things where I'm like, God, I got to survive this. And I did, fortunately, you know, no heart attack. But I was at that breaking point. And let's figure out what I can do right the second time. And do it over.
Well, because not everything went wrong, right? I mean, if you look back at the experience, right, and I think that's really what I'm hoping that people see, that clearly you didn't recognize early enough that you have sunk costs and you got to walk away from them, right? I think that would be a lesson. Well, let's talk about the lessons. I mean, to me, that's an obvious lesson now because I'm getting the benefit of none of the pain, right? Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of the lessons that you learned that are maybe what I'm really kind of looking for are the absolutes now.
Mm-hmm.
Are there some absolutes that have come from that whole experience for you?
So me, it was a go big or go home, right, initially. And I was just, I was fighting every day to get bigger, 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 right? And I was chasing that top number. How many, you know, what's my gross sales figure? And how many employees do I employ? Because I always thought creating jobs was something I was super proud of, right, locally here. And so how many jobs am I creating and what's my top sales number? You know, do I rank in the top, you know, top sellers on eBay? Those were all glamour statistics or stats, right? And I realized they were false goals in my case, right? They weren't what truly satisfied me as a person, right? They were goals that, you know, looked good on the surface, but inside they didn't satisfy me. I didn't feel, you know, complete with that. So false goals would be one of those lessons. And then investing behind those false goals, right? Building for an unknown future, right? Things go right. Sometimes, you know, you can predict the future sometimes, but not 100% of the time. And so you always want to prepare for the predictions that you can't predict, right? The things that happen that you can't predict. So that uncertainty.
You have to factor in risk, right? That uncertainty, just what you're saying. You have to factor that into the formula. And I have one of those fancy MBAs too. You were trained that way, just like I was, right? That's a formula, mm-hmm. right? That's a math formula. And I find that when you're in that growth mode, you don't see the downside ever, and you never factor that in.
Well, success blinds you from failure. You know, for me, I was growing 30% month after month after month for, you know, many years. I mean, it was almost like a guarantee. I could bank on the next month being higher. And so you blind yourself, and you feel like you're invincible for a while, right? Nah, there's no way I can fail at this now. So let's double down. Let's double down again. Okay, we're going to double down again, you know. And eventually you can over-leverage yourself and double. Yep. You know, you're doubling down too many times, and things don't come up rosy every time.
Right. And I think that's just great. So the business didn't do well. You curled up in a ball in the corner, started sucking your thumb, or how did you come out of it?
Probably for a few days. Okay. But I'm the sole income provider for my family. I've got a wife and two kids, right? And so I had no money in the bank, totally broke, no job, no income. I had less than 30 days to pay that mortgage. So I didn't want to lose the house. You know, that was the number one thing, was not to disrupt my family's lifestyle or, you know, comfort to some degree, right? As much as I could, that was numero uno. So I wanted to get back into e-commerce, and I did, but I did a little consulting along the way. Obviously, my reputation helped me grab some gigs fairly easily. And then some large companies came to me and said, Brandon, I heard you're on the market. You know, we'd like to hire you. But obviously, I didn't want to work for corporations. So I said, okay, let me, you know, I'll consult for a while. So I was able to satisfy the mortgage, so to speak. But at the same time, I wanted to rethink this e-commerce thing, because I was also going traveling around, you know, the country and even, you know, internationally, and speaking on stage about how to sell on eBay and how to, you know, build an e-commerce business. So here I am. I just went out of business, and I'm trying to help other people start an eBay or an e-commerce business. So it was kind of a weird situation, honestly. And so I had this feeling in my, you know, internally, I was struggling with that, right? On one side, I'm like, can you really build an e-commerce business these days, or is it too competitive? You know, is it too late? And on the other hand, I'm like, I'm teaching these people to do it. I better try to do it as well, even though I wanted to. I mean, I still wanted to, but I wanted to prove to myself that it was possible once again, even from scratch in 2006.
Because you were successful at it, and looking back at it, you had the chops. You know, as you say, over leverage and all the rest of that. And let's face it, that was outside of your control, them going to China to expand their market. Do you think that's one of the, you know, when you look at missteps that eBay made, right? So eBay right now is trying to, I don't know what they're doing. I mean, you know, they're a good company, and I sell a lot of stuff on eBay too, so I'm not bad mouthing them. But they've taken a lot of stumbles, right, in their growing phases. And it seems like they're trying to come out of it now. But would you say that was one of their big stumbles? Or would you say that was one of their big successes?
Oh, I mean, it depends on, you know, who's the stakeholder, right? Who's the one that's going to be benefiting from that decision? As a domestic U.S. seller, it was a mistake, obviously, because domestic sellers felt the pain from that. A lot of them went out of business, not just me, right? But if you look at the stockholders, you know, and you look at the employees, you look at the international landscape, it was the right decision for eBay, obviously. They, you know, the world was becoming global. If it wasn't them, it was going to be Alibaba, right? And so It was. I totally get the decision. I mean, I can't fault them for that. For their company, they were made the right decision at the right time early on, and they did what they should have done. I just happened to be on the wrong side of that, decision as a stakeholder, okay, as a seller domestically.
Okay. And if you were sourcing from China before then and bringing stuff in, you could have really benefited because all of a sudden this major channel would open up for you. Okay, I got it. Okay, so you started back in business and you said, hey, I'm going out to make my mortgage. Tell us how you started and then what happened from there.
So, taking the lessons I learned from the past, right? I knew how to market. I knew how to sell. I knew how to source. I knew all the numbers. I know all those things. But one of the things I realized is I didn't want the overheads. I didn't want the need to have to go in the office every day because I have to pay the warehouse rent, or I have to pay, the salaries for these employees. So I felt like in business 1.0, I tied myself down. So instead of them working for me, I felt like I was working for them as much, right? And I didn't want that. So business number two, a lot of my friends called it Brandon 2.0, right? I love that. Back then they were like, I can't wait to see Brandon 2.0. So, I focused on what can I do different and better, right? What's the new model? And the new model was lean and mean, right? I wanted to build what I called the smallest, biggest e-commerce business. I want the smallest operations, but I want to make good, profitable numbers. And so, I wrote down this goal. I kind of came up with it, out of the blue. But I wanted to do $1 million a year, right? So, and it was basically because of the profitability. I knew that profitability could support my family and lifestyle. And I wanted to do it in 1 year's time. And I wanted to only work 1 hour per day. And so it was kind of like and I only wanted to have one employee, me. I was like, there's a one I'm missing here. So it's the 1-1-1-1 goal, right? It was like I just wrote down 1-1-1-1, and I knew what that meant. And so because I was traveling and speaking on stage, and because I was doing some consulting on the side, I only had a little bit of time. And so it really forced me to rethink how to sell online through an e-commerce business with only about an hour a day to do it. And in 2009, I reached that goal.
And you still, I mean, that, imagine in 2009, now there are those of us who would love to reduce the number of hours, right? I mean, I see some of the hours people are starting to really pound out the pavement now. You went into it with that model saying, you know what, I want to grow a business again, but now I'm going to put some constraints in place, right? One, hey, I'm not going into big debt. Two, I'm only willing to give this many hours to the business. So that those parameters you put on it were really – I mean, they're really limits. I mean, they're real heavy limits. So you really had to be successful very quickly or you were going to fail.
Exactly. And I think that because I limited myself, I forced myself to figure out how to do it. Okay. If you've got the luxury of time, you kind of waste it. I mean, we're good at wasting time as individuals, right? And so if we didn't have that time available to us, we are just far more efficient with our time, the time that we have left. And so having those constraints were probably a requirement for me to reach that goal. Otherwise, I would have floundered the time I had, right? It goes back to also, like, I love Simon Sinek, the start with why, right? Why? And, in my first business, I was go big or go home. The why was, I wanted to be at the top. It was the entrepreneur drive to, get on the front cover of Forbes or Fortune magazine type stuff, right? But that was, to me, unfulfilling eventually. And so now the why is the family, right? My wife and kids, my kids are growing older, and it's the time that I didn't spend with them the first time that I want to make sure I'm here for the second time. And so it was really the why for me was the family. I do not want to sit and tie myself down to a computer at a desk all day long and waste that time that I could be doing, better things with.
I love that approach. So let's take and apply that to people that are out. You met a lot of sellers, right? You meet a lot of sellers. Mm-hmm. So they're all, I think time is the number one factor. If people would say that the number one challenge in their game, it's probably not going to be money. Money would be up there, but it isn't really money. It's time. Mm-hmm. So what would you recommend to people who are, they're doing well, but they're running. and they're running and they're running. What did you do, or what would you suggest that somebody's in that boat right now? How do they start to get control of it? What's the steps that you would suggest?
Okay, so I totally get it. You're right. That is the number one challenge from people I ask is time. You know, 9 times out of 10, that's the answer. And because time is more valuable than money, honestly. And so, you know, really I try to look at, okay, what is my time worth, right? And I say most people undervalue their time's worth, right? And so they end up doing all these tasks, such as answering emails, such as packing and shipping and processing orders. And so I've kind of bucketized all these tasks as moving money tasks, right? You package a box, you answer an email, you even build a listing. These are all moving money tasks. They don't make you the money. They're just taking it from, you know, step one to, or point one to point two, or point A to point B. And they're necessary for your business, but they're not necessary for you to do. Maybe you can do it better, but they're not necessary for you to do. So I like to look at these moving parts or moving money parts and try to outsource those. So outsource them with virtual assistants. I use third-party warehousing. All those moving parts are what's holding them back, most likely, and especially in an e-commerce business. And then focus your time on the money-making tasks, okay? And the money-making tasks is mostly, you know, I hate saying working smart, not hard, because I like working hard too. But it's really focusing on working smart and spending your time on adding value to your business and your customers' experience, your brand, and so forth. Adding value using your intelligence rather than your hands and your time.
Well, give us an example. So you know, I mean, let's take it backwards. You use a logistics company to handle distribution for you, especially because you came from that field. You're very comfortable in it. You know exactly what you go in and you talk to them. So you're using Amazon to do some distribution for you, right? You're using FBA?
Yep, for FBA selling, yes.
Right. You're using another company to do eBay fulfillment and to do fulfillment for your large website.
Correct.
And so how difficult is it for the average Joe, average Steve here, you know, who's doing, you know, $300,000-$500,000. How difficult is it for me to get into the logistics, to find a logistics vendor?
So I think the problem is control for the most part and quality. Everybody always says, you know, I always hear from people that are at that stage saying, well, I'm worried about control. Are they going to ship it good enough? Are they going to ship the right items? And so I think my background of having, you know, almost 100 employees working for me got me past that problem, right? I was used to giving up control. I had to for my company, the big company, right? And so outsourcing to virtual assistants and outsourcing to third-party systems, I already understood the fact that quality might not be the same if I'm doing it. But what I gain in time and freedom of mind, I don't have to think about it, is so much more valuable than having it perfect every time.
Well, are you able to factor it in some way to say, I know I'm not going to get as good of a quality, but if I do this, I can live with it? Is there a way you can factor it or you know, put an edge on it?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a friend who's a perfectionist. And so I've always gone to him and said, perfection is the devil. Good enough. What's that saying? The good enough is the
enemy of great?
Of perfection or something. Perfection is the enemy of good enough. But I'm a good enough person, okay? I'm the type that wants to roll something out that's good enough, you know, in most cases. And so that helps me not have to worry about perfectionism. I mean, I make mistakes, right? And I'm human.
Yeah, you perfect? I was going to say, Greg Murphy always said, if I get 80% from somebody, that's about as much as I'm going to give, too. That's pretty much – I'm never perfect.
Exactly.
I think that's great advice. You're the second person to tell me that.
Yeah. So you – and a lot of entrepreneurs, they love quality control, image, brand. You know, they're worried about all that stuff. And honestly, a third-party warehouse company can do warehousing, packing, and shipping better than you can because they do it every day, day in and day out, and they do it, you know, on a scale that you cannot reach. And so most times, they're going to do it better than you, and that's the part that people forget. You know, they're, my product's unique or something's, you know, special with my service and blah, blah, blah. And they try to hedge themselves or protect themselves from losing that control. But in a nutshell, most of the time, other people can do it better than you. You don't want to be in the warehousing business. You don't want to be in the packing and shipping business. That's not why you started your e-commerce business, most likely.
How about this question? So you use Amazon Fulfillment for FBA items.
Mm-hmm.
And I always use a round number of about a third, right? I mean, typically they take about 30% in cost by the time you're done, depending on the price of the product. And I know it varies and all the rest of that jazz. How different is it using a logistic company, because they have the pick and pack, and then you're paying for the box. You're paying. I mean, it's incremental, right? They have all the little dinky costs are all broken out. How much difference is there versus Amazon when you use a third party logistics company?
Oh, Amazon's going to be more expensive still. So, and I sell in electronics, so it's an 8%, you know, commission plus maybe. And I sell high dollar electronics mostly, right?
Okay.
So, but I do have some smaller dollar stuff. But it's more of a 2-4% maybe if you factored in an FBA based on the cost of the goods. So I'm looking at about a 10-12%, not 30. So, you know, and that's by design. I obviously don't like to work hard. I like to work smart as much as I can, and that comes from the average selling price. You know, the higher.
So your average selling price is in the hundreds.
$300 to $500 for most of my products, besides a few Amazon products that I sell high volume on.
Well, let's scale it back to you sell lower priced items too, right? So could you give me a frame of reference for something, you know, in the $35 to $40 range? Would you then agree that Amazon would take roughly 25% to 30%?
I can tell you in a minute. I've got a dashboard that tells you my sales and profitability line by line, and on an Amazon item. Still about 25% to 30%.
Okay, so 25 to 30%. Okay. So what would that be on the logistics side? I'm just trying to get a frame of reference because I don't think people, myself included, remember this. This is the real goal of this podcast is so Steve could learn a lot of stuff. I mean, this is really the goal. Is I don't have a frame of reference to understand how much they would charge for a similar service.
So the third-party logistics companies are usually a volume type of a business model.
Okay.
So they're you know they're packing hundreds to thousands of orders a day. You know, they might have conveyors, barcode scanners, you know, all the narrow aisle forklifts, you name it, right? And so they're used to doing high volume, low dollar cost association to the transaction. And so if you go to some high volume businesses, they're only going to charge you, you know, $1 to $2 to pack and ship it. You know, it depends
on
the product.
So on a $35 item or a $40 item in our scenario, I mean, it's pennies, right?
It is.
But what about the guy who's selling, you know, 1,000 items? All right, maybe that's a better question. I'm going to get a better question yet.
Mm-hmm.
How soon would you suggest somebody going into a logistics company? And I think of Brandon Gompers. Brandon Gompers is a seller who's a great FBA seller, but he's been taking back his sales so he can build a Shopify store. And he's really working hard on it. And he's using Amazon to fulfill. But at what point would you suggest to Brandon to say, you know what, you're large enough to start using a logistic company because you're going to get the economies of scale with pricing?
I would say very early in this case, in any case. So the earlier the better, because when you're learning something new, you're trusting an unknown factor, right? It's always better to do that when things are smaller than larger, of course, right? So take those risks, learn those ways when the pain won't, you know, the pain of the lessons won't be as painful. I like to bring things in-house. Like if you've got a new product or a new model or a new brand, bring them in-house to kind of feel them out, right? Feel the product out, test it out, get used to it, know it inside and out, upside and down, and make sure you know what's going to pack, like how's it going to pack and ship, and all those things. Once you feel like you know that product well enough, hand it over. So it might be right out of the gate, you might want to use a third-party warehouse, you know, your first month in business. I say do it early because then it's baked into your process, just like I baked in a lot of those constraints I told you about on my second business.
Well, and you've obviously had success with it. And again, what you said was go work on revenue-enhancing opportunities, right? Use your brain, packing boxes, and I'm not putting it down. I don't want to put anybody down in that way. I don't mean in a negative way. That's not the best use of your time. And so you're saying, hey, get in early, set it up right from day one. Because, quite frankly, it's still not going to cost more than 25% or 30%, no matter what, correct?
I mean, usually they can do it cheaper and more efficient than you can. Once you add in the space, the insurance, the, you know, the water bill, the electric bill, the internet bill for all your I had warehouses. So if you have a warehouse, all those overhead expenses that go with it add up far more than if you outsource it. And even if you considered what you're using in your home for overhead, right? You're using space in your garage or your basement, you know, you've got electricity, you've got water. All those little things add up that people
pressure on your marriage.
Exactly.
Right?
The pressure in the home, in the space that, you know, your wife wants back or your husband wants back. Right.
Right.
So, yes, I say do it early. If
okay,
you know.
I think that's great advice, and I think it's I think there's a lot of sellers coming to this place, and they're saying, I want to do my own e-commerce, right? I don't want to rely on one marketplace today because it is so dominant. And let's face it, you have to be in it, and you're in it, but that's not your dominant only marketplace, right? Well, let's ask that question. What percentage of your sales, if you don't mind sharing, would you say are eBay, your own e-commerce sites, and Amazon?
Okay, so my website's over 80% now.
Okay, so now I want people to hear that again. 80% of your sales are done through your website, handled through your logistics company, under all your control the way you want. You're not jumping through hoops saying you got to put 2 inches around and doing all those jazz for 80% of your sales, correct?
That is correct. So that was one of my other criteria that I had when I got out, started business 2.0, I was going to succeed on a website versus eBay and Amazon, because eBay changes things, Amazon changes things, and they became a single point of failure for me, right? They made a decision that wasn't in my best interest. And so that could happen again, and I wasn't going to put myself in that situation or my family back in that situation, right? So my website was a requirement. I had to succeed on a website. Now, some encouragement for me was I used to go to all these eBay Lives, Amazon, conferences, and, you get kind of tunnel vision that those are the only places to sell on because of how you sell, right? And I went to Inc. 500, okay? And I went to an Inc. 500 conference, which is kind of outside the circle of e-commerce sellers, that we talk to for the most part. And I talked to all these website owners. They're in the Inc. 500 list, right? So we're the 125th, largest e-commerce seller, whatever. And they were having huge success online with websites. And that convinced me I can do it as well. It's just a different type of game.
I think that you bring up a really great point. Andy Simons brings up the same point. We are a small group of e-commerce sellers, and we think we're a big group, right? Because mm-hmm. we can go to a Jim Cockrum's CES conference, and there's 500 sellers, right? And it's an amazing group, or there's a few thousand, or Bob Willey has 15,000 members in his group, and Chris Green does too. We're nobody, though. I mean, there are millions of sellers. We're just a small microcosm, as you're saying. And when you stepped out of our group, the pond was much bigger. Ram Charan, I remember seeing him as a famous author and strategist, and he always said, when you're the biggest fish in your pond, get a bigger pond, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you see things. So by stepping back and jumping into that bigger pond, you saw that there are a lot more opportunities than just eBay and Amazon. And they're both great opportunities, so I don't want to downplay that.
Mm-hmm.
But you were able to see that, and that was, again, one of your criterias. How hard was it? I mean, I guess because you had all this experience, the intimidation factor of any of this stuff is gone for you, right?
Oh, I was scared initially. I was like, I was petrified. Is this going to work every single day? I mean, in the early stages, I was like, this isn't going to work, Brandon. I almost talked myself out of it. Go get a job, And so I had to battle that for a long, long time because I felt like I did everything I possibly could the first time, right? But it was a different situation. I'm in a new situation now without the overheads and without the employees, so I can be more nimble and adjust to changes. But the difference between a website and a marketplace, let's say, it was totally the challenge for me. Okay, so I had to learn a whole new method of how to sell online. I felt like I was starting over, from the learning standpoint. Yes, I could, take photos of products and write a description, but not like I have to write a description on a website. It's totally different.
It is.
And so I feel like that's the chasm that sellers struggle with, that want to make that leap from a marketplace to a website. And I forced myself to climb over that or jump over that chasm and learn, how to do so. But that's the one challenge I see most sellers still struggling with, I think, if they're trying to do that.
Well, tell us about, and I don't want to make this a two-hour presentation on, SEO or not even SEO mm-hmm. anymore. Give us, what would you suggest, right? I guess that's kind of where I want to go, is you got a bunch of sellers that are, let's talk about the people who are doing well right now. They're having a great fourth quarter. Things are going well. They're in the largest marketplace out there, the most dominant marketplace in Amazon. They're crushing it for what they have. However, kind of what you saw when you started seeing Disney come in there, there is a little bit of writing on the wall, and it's not doom and gloom, and I'm not saying that the marketplace is going anywhere in the next several years. I really don't believe it will. But there will be changes, and I think that's the item that we got to factor in. That's the risk. Those changes don't always benefit you. Mm-hmm. They might benefit me more than you because I sell in a different category than you, right? Or they might benefit someone else because Amazon gets out of a whole line of merchandise. They decide not sell that merchandise themselves or only go in a third party, or they decide to buy another company, and now all of a sudden they put their own merchandise in, right? So how do we get people to move from the successful sellers to move in another direction in addition to the Amazon? Is that possible to do both simultaneously?
You have to have a different frame of mind and a different set of skills and a different approach to find the success on a website versus a marketplace, in my opinion. And so I frame it, you know, big picture-ish. I'm like, selling on a marketplace predominantly is what I consider e-commerce selling, okay? And I'll even, you know, I might hurt some people's feelings here, but I call it the copy-paste model. You're taking it from one place, copying it and putting it in another place and pasting it. Now, you know, some people are into the private labeling, branding, you know, adding value and so forth. So that would be a copy paste premium, I guess, right? And that's great. I mean, you know, people can make a ton of money doing that, right? But selling on a website is totally what I call online merchandising or an online merchant. Okay. And so you have to really have a merchant's hat, and there's a difference here. It's marketing, it's brand building, it's experience. And so that's the part that excites me. I mean, I get up in the morning, and sometimes I wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning just because I can't sleep because I'm excited. And I'm like, how can I, you know, change something on my website? An idea comes to me, and I can change something on my website. It's my sandbox, right? And I can make that customer experience far more fun or far more exciting or far more memorable, right? And that's the part that I love. That's the part that, you know, still gets me excited every day after doing this for 18 years is the website and those kind of freedoms.
You way back in the day, the logistics piece had to be exciting for you because you came from that industry and you knew it. Mm-hmm. And so you were good at it, right? Mm-hmm. So you grew from that, and then you grew into the sourcing side, right? Because especially when you're finding amazing deals, that's a high, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a real rush. Mm-hmm. You kind of lost the fun of that too, right? I'm sure it got beat out of you through that whole loss.
Oh, you lose 5 deals to every one you make, right? So it's right. Not always a win-win.
Right. So you get past that point of that being the thrill, right? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are getting there, and I'm hearing more and more of that. You've been able to get that high back, that enjoyment, that pleasure in fulfilling customers' wants, really, right? I mean, they're out there looking. You don't even know what they're looking for. You're anticipating it, and you're putting it in a way so it meets their needs, so they're not going to an Amazon or eBay or anywhere else to buy it. They're buying it from you. I think that's a real cool place to see if you can make that shift. Is there, you know, do you have to be an entrepreneur? Is it more of an art background? Is it a finance background? What kind of background is the right background for that?
I say numbers first. I mean, you know, from an e-commerce standpoint, if you want to be successful, it's numbers first. You have to know your numbers. You have to know what you're making and where you're making it, how you're making it, you know, what's the velocity of it, and so on and so forth. Knowing your numbers. But there's a ton of art involved. You know, from crossing to an online seller to an online merchant, you need to have the arts side. Now, I'm left-handed. I, you know, people say I'm artsy-fartsy too, and creative and so forth. And so I feel like I leverage that, you know, to some extreme on being able to build my website. And some people have it, some, you know, are just so much stronger on the number side and just can't see the photo, you know, the visual side of it as much. But for example, let me give you an example on my website. So just this weekend, I did a whole new makeover on my retail website. And I sell to parents with young kids, right? So from a brand experience side, I've been struggling with this one for a while. How do I make it more memorable? And so finally I came up to the theme of a comic book, okay? And so we went through, and I had a graphic designer who's a professional, you know, wordsmith artist, website designer, so forth, rebuild my homepage for me. And so now my customer experience from when they hit my website to when they receive the product and when they use the product is all about comic book fun or superpowers or super parenting or super kids and epic and wows and kabooms and all those things. And so that's, to me, that's exciting because I get to create an environment. It's kind of like Walt Disney, you know, creating magical land, right? I'm creating my own little experience. If you come to my website, you get to experience whatever I create, right? And that's the part that I love.
I'm looking at it right now, and I love, you're right, it is. It's Marvel-like. I mean, I can see the art, and it's such a great presentation. It's such a great way, and it's so relevant and relative to kids, right? So you're really trying to be relevant and relative to the age you're trying to sell, right? Because are the kids buying this for their parents, right? Making their parents buy it? Is that the way it works?
No. It's the parents. So I'm speaking specifically to parents, right? You've got a vacation coming up. Buy my product. You'll have a more epic vacation, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm speaking the language. It's called, you know, I do a lot of, you know, reading of books and studying of the marketing, the messaging, and so forth. And I call it the brand voice. You know, what voice are you talking to? What's your brand voice, you know, when you're talking to them? And what's their trance? What's on their mind the moment they land on your website or the moment they land on your product page, right? What's on their mind? And you've got to speak to them at that level at that exact moment and then walk them a baby steps along the way to your checkout.
80% of your sales is coming from this site. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Just incredible to me. I mean, it's just amazing. Brandon, you have shared so much information with us tonight, and I want to respect your time. You know, it was good, but it's just I don't think it answered it. So, you know, one of the goals of this podcast is to help people who are stuck, right? And I think you were at a place that was beyond stuck, right? And you were able to rise past it. I think you've learned some amazing lessons. They stuck with you. You now have them in place. So I'm looking for something that can help, you know, semi-successful sellers who are – or even really successful. I've talked to a few really successful sellers who are getting tired of the model that they're using. So, you know, how would you suggest that people get started in planning their business? Because I think that's one of the things that you've been so successful at is planning. How would you suggest people could get started in planning for a real business – not a job. I'm not saying that everybody has one, but a lot of people have created themselves a pretty good job. We want to help them get a business. What would you suggest?
Okay, so I mentioned Simon Sinek earlier. You know, start with the why, and I still think that's relevant. I'm going to steal it from him or borrow it, I suppose. Is the why? And so for me, my why was, you know, different from business one to business two, and I feel like because of that why, it really geared or steered the rest of all my actions. And so sit back and, you know, you've got to sit back, step back, you know, step away from your business, get out of the, you know, the noise for a while and really ask why. Why am I doing this, right? Why am I building this business? And once you have that why and it's very clear, then it's a how. How do I do it, you know, the way that I want it? For me, it was time, right? It was all about time, time, time. I want to get the most out of my time. And that was the why, so I could spend it with my family, right? So that was the why that was powerful enough for me to build my business around that. I could have, you know, got the 9-to-5 going again. I could have worked 12 hours and 14-hour days again like before. But the why stopped me, right? And so they've got to come up with a why that's motivating enough to make those changes. But then it's a matter of how they spend their time. I mean, put a price on their time, you know, whether it's $200, $500 an hour, whatever. Put a price that's way higher than what you currently are paying, you know, are valuing it at. And try to steer yourself so that that's what you earn in value for your time.
And then measure everything you do against that, right? Against your why, right?
Mm-hmm.
If this doesn't work towards my why, stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Move on. Find another person. You know, find something else. Everything you do needs to be working towards your why. Otherwise, find another way to get it done, right? That's really
– yeah.
I think that's great advice. I think that is so actionable for people, and I think your advice to get away. So we're in the fourth quarter. It's hot and heavy. It'll be over in a few weeks. I mean, you know, it's hard to think about that it's, you know, the middle of November, and it will be over in a few weeks. But now is the time to start planning. Put on your calendar – some time away. You know, I always love, you know, when I hear Bill Gates going away into a cabin by himself and reading white papers for, you know, I think 2 weeks or something like that. You know, let's face it, you want to have a clear head. You know, that's what you do. So get away, plan, and think how you're going to fulfill your why, right? And then I just think that's such sound advice. Mm-hmm. I think it's so actionable, Brandon. Brandon, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you and find out more?
Okay, so I've got one website that's pretty busy right now. It's called E-commerce Money for Nothing. You know, it's about saving your time, right? And so it's ecommercemoney.com. Just as it sounds. Okay. But I'm actually rethinking, as you said, I'm rethinking 2016 right now, and I'm rebranding myself. People are always searching for me, right? And they come to my e-commerce money website. So I said, why am I hiding behind a brand when I'm the brand? Okay. And So I just launched BrandonDubsky.com. Okay. It's very fresh. It's very new. For 2016, that's where people will find me most. You can find me at both.
And I'll have links to all that for you. Your frame of reference about redoing your goals for next year, Dan Miller, who I interviewed, and Dan said that he gets rid of 15% of what he's doing every single year. It's gone,
that's
no matter
great.
What. Even if it's profitable, even if it's successful, and he said it usually is, because he just knows that he's going to replace it with something even bigger. And that's so powerful. So
I love that.
Man, I love your story. I love, everybody loves to hear a success story, you know, the underdog coming through and winning. But, you know, you're as real as they come. It's the genuine Brandon Dubsky. That's what you really should call it, because you are such a genuine, great guy. We had breakfast. We were helping another person, and it was just such a great, candid conversation. I just really appreciate what you do, and I can't wait to see you again. I look forward to it, and I just want to thank you again for taking the time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and likewise, I've enjoyed our discussions and our conversations. This is what I love. I mean, when I go to those conferences, I will stay there till 3 o'clock in the morning to talk about e-commerce. Why? Because there's no other chance to do that. You know, we're all in our own little silos, our own little worlds. We got to embrace that time together, because it's what I love doing.
Ecom Chicago. It'll be again next year. I'll have a link to it when it gets up. And I really enjoyed myself. I met so many great people, and Brandon was one of them. So, hey, Brandon, you have a great night. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. You too.
Man, I hope you really enjoyed listening to that. He is such a great guy. It is such a great story. I hope you come out to Ecommerce Momentum website and take a look around. There's a whole bunch of stuff we've been adding over the last couple weeks, and we're going to be adding a ton more. A lot of resources for you and your business. There's so many great interviews. If you're looking to be inspired, if you're looking for answers, if you're looking for help, I've interviewed those people. Just go take a listen. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. All the links mentioned today can be found at ecommercemomentum.com under this episode number. Please remember to subscribe and like us on iTunes.